I'm good with this mouse.
The mouse is really
what?
Jumpy.
I'm just trying to get the mouse down there. Okay.
While we're doing the tech, I'm going to send the sign-in sheet around again because there were lots of folks who joined us after we sent it around for the first time. If there's not enough space, because we have a full room again, just sign on the back, please. Thanks.
Okay. So, Mark and I are presenting a paper on the deterrence gap in employment standards enforcement, and as you can see, there are more than us as co-authors. There are four of us. Leah and John are also co-authors on this paper, and as well, this project is supported by a team of research assistants, some of whom are here, Elliot, Lisa, and Jason. So in a sense, Mark and I are on the tip of the research pyramid, which is something, as I go through the paper, might make more sense to you a little bit later. Anyway, so the goal of our paper is sort of twofold. On the one hand, we want to be able to describe the role of deterrence in employment standards enforcement, which involves the collection of enforcement data from the Ministry of Labor. And so Mark will talk about the data that we've been able to get so far, and of course, one of the things, I don't want to sort of preempt you, but one of the most frustrating aspects of the research so far, and our assistants are well aware of this, is how bad the data is. One would have thought that, just to collect 20 years of data, this should be readily available, and it's actually turning out to be quite difficult. Hopefully, we'll be able to get better data in the next few weeks or months after we sort of get some more have an agreement with the Ministry of Labor and get more cooperation. So we're still in the process, and Mark will talk about this, taking a snapshot, really, of what the story is. But, of course, on the other hand, to answer the question of whether or not there's a deterrence gap, it's not enough to simply have data. You have to be able to put that data into some kind of conceptual or theoretical framework. And so that's the other part of what we've done in this paper, is to sort of look at the theory of deterrence and then use that as a basis for then evaluating the data that we have. And so I'm going to start talking about our conceptualization of the role of deterrence, and then I'll hand it over to Mark, who'll talk about the data and just a few brief conclusions that we've reached so far in this. So some of this may be familiar to you, and it overlaps in part with Leah's presentation on new governance, because there are now these sort of a spectrum of strategies that are often referred to as the deterrence strategy and the compliance strategy. And the compliance strategy, of course, is closely associated with a new governance. If you can keep track of that. I'm actually changing it on my own laptop, but it's not changing up there. One of those little technical things. Okay, so in this chart that now you can see, what I've tried to do is outline a number of key sort of aspects of the theory of deterrence and the theory of compliance, and so we can sort of talk about the ways in which they differ. So first of all, if we think about, the subjects of regulation, how does the government see violators of law, right, and specifically of employment standards law. So in a deterrence model, the idea is that the government sees rational calculators, people trying to decide, right, am I better off complying with the law or violating the law? How will I come out at the end of that? For compliance or new governance approaches, The general view is that where there's non-compliance with the law, it's because people are either ignorant of what the law is or they're just incompetent. They you know, it's just complicated and they don't have the tools and, you know, so they need, you know, so that's why we're most of the law breaking, at least in the area of regulation, is taking place. Well, secondly, what is the kind of harms that are resulting from these violations in a deterrence model? There's generally the notion, right, we're dealing with serious social harm and harm to individuals at both levels from these violations. On the other hand, with compliance strategies, there's often sort of a softening of that. Well, these are kind of, you know, remedial problems that can be remediated, and they take place in the course of people engaging in valued social activities like production of goods and services, right? So we shouldn't overly stigmatize and the kinds of harms that result from this. What's the goal in a deterrence model? You have to alter the cost-benefit analysis, right, so that people think it's actually they're better off complying with the law than violating it. And in compliance, again, it's much more softer, right? We just have to promote, encourage people to perform better. How do you do that? Again, in a deterrence model, you use what's the risk of being detected and what's the penalty, right? So you take the penalty, discount it by the risk of being caught, and that's your cost of violation, and then, you know, you have to make sure that the costs of violation are higher than the benefits that you might get from violating the law. On the other hand, in a compliance model, you know, what you most will rely on is information and compliance assistance. Teach people about what the law is and help them become more competent, right, in obeying the law. And what kind of effects do you want to get in a deterrence model? It's specific and general deterrence, right? If someone gets caught, you need to impose a penalty so that they both individually will learn a lesson and also they will be made an example of to the broader community so that it will have this more general deterrent effect. On the other hand, in a compliance model, right, the effect of the law is you want to promote a culture, they often use, of compliance or sometimes even going beyond compliance so that people will become not only minimally obey the law but actually try to do good, right, in some broader way to be good performers. So that's sort of these sort of two ideal types. Of course, in reality, no system of enforcement is a purely compliance model or a purely deterrence model. There almost always be some combination of the two. And here's where we get to the pyramid. A very, very popular approach to enforcement of how you combine compliance and deterrence techniques is this notion of a pyramid, that you start with compliance strategies in the expectation that the overwhelming majority of violations will be corrected in that process. And only after those tools have failed do you start to move up the pyramid into deterrence strategies, and you become increasingly punitive if people don't get it, right, by being subject to these lesser kinds of sanctions. But it's very important, right, even for the most ardent compliance theorists, they always say, right, that there's got to be a credible threat of deterrence. Because, you know, even in their ideal world, they recognize that there are laggards, that there are no goods, you know, some part of the population, right, is going to have to be subject to a level of deterrence. So you have to have it. But that leaves it completely open, right? How important will deterrence be in your compliance model? Ideally, it should, you know, for people who really believe in new governance compliance strategies, right, those lower level activities should take care of most of the problems most of the time. It's only the bad apples, right, that will need to be subject to deterrence strategies. Okay, so in our work, we want to conceptually, and I only have 10 minutes, so keep me on track.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm gonna, so we want to challenge, you know, sort of a lot of this common sense about the pyramid. So first of all, a couple of things. Obviously, it's based on certain assumptions about the character of violations and the social harm that's caused by violations. If we, you know, adopt the view that I articulated before, then that justifies the pyramid. But if we start changing our assumptions, right? If we start thinking that, well, it's not just that people are incompetent or ignorant, right? But we actually are living in a world in which there are structural pressures through contracting out and subcontracting that put employers in increasingly competitive situations, so that the temptations and the, you know, to violate employment standards in order to be able to make a living, not necessarily people making rich, just small business people trying to eke out a living in a highly competitive environment, because we've restructured workplaces to create more of those environments, we're going to get a lot more violations, right? But that's different than people just being ignorant or incompetent, right? It's understanding the structural environment in which violations are taking place. And if we see that the harm isn't just that someone isn't getting paid, right, but as John was talking about, erosion and evasion, a norm of where violations become conventionalized and accepted, then we think that the harm is actually much more greater. It's not enough just to pay the individual worker what he or she is owed, right? But there's a broader social harm that's being caused by this process. And if we change those assumptions, then we get a different mind. We think, well, promotion might do a little good, but it's not going to do a whole lot of good. Orders to compensate, well, they should always be issued, but we need to do more. We need to, where we find violations, to, you know, also impose some kind of penalty, and in some cases a significant penalty. Okay, very quickly. Pyramids, again, raise the question, right? You might say we have a pyramid, but how high, how steep, right? So notionally, yeah, there's a pyramid, but if there's very little deterrence in it, then that tells us, you know, the model, the significance of the model changes quite substantially. Very important point as well is how much of the universe of violations actually gets into enforcement, right? John is talking about this telephone survey that we're doing to try to get a better sense of what that universe of violations is, right? But how, to what extent, what is the risk of those violations being detected? So, you know, in a self-enforcement model, we are very skeptical, right, about that being a way of getting violations resolved. A complaint-driven system, as John was saying, is deeply flawed. So we're very interested in looking at the extent to which we have a system of proactive inspections that will bring more. So how wide is the base of the pyramid, right? Is the pyramid capturing the realm of violations, or is it just the little thing sticking on top of a much bigger world that isn't getting into it? And finally, and this will be my transition, we're also interested in how the shape of the pyramid changes over time, right? What are actually the, it's not just an ideal model that structures how government enforces law, it's the result of a political process, right? So pyramids are not static. Pyramids, whatever the enforcement model is, it's changing over time, and so we want to get a handle on what the politics of enforcement are. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark, who'll talk about a little bit about that history and what we're finding.
Okay, thanks, Eric. I'll move a little quicker just to be mindful of the time, but what I want to do is just set a little bit of on what we're calling the deterrence gap in Ontario, set that in historical context, and then give you a sense of what we've been able to gather so far from the data we've been collecting from the Ministry of Labour, and recognizing this is an ongoing project and we still have a lot of data to collect, but we're piecing together what we can work with. Very briefly, we're talking about employment standards in Ontario, so we're talking about the Employment Standards Act, which was enacted in 1968. And to use the terminology of the Ministry of Labour and to capture its aims, one of the primary aims of the Employment Standards Act was to promote socially acceptable conditions of employment for those workers in the province who don't have strong bargaining power, which includes those who are not unionized, which, you know, includes, you know, the majority of workers in one way or another in the province. In terms of enforcing the Act, primarily the compliance approach that Eric has been talking about has been the primary way in which the ESA was enforced, and largely through individual worker complaints. When people believe they've experienced a violation in their workplace, they can file a complaint with the Ministry of Labor, and this is the primary way in which the Act is designed to work. And also self-reliance. In the terminology of the ministry, self-reliance meaning that workers and employers are to figure these things out themselves and resolve complaints and disputes as they arise without the need to go to the ministry. And ideally, again, thinking of the pyramid, at least as it's conceptualized from the Ministry of Labor, this includes providing employers with the education and information they need to create fair and socially acceptable conditions of employment. Just a brief quote from the Minister of Labor in 1969 to capture this and their emphasis on compliance up here on the slide. He describes this quite clearly, where he claims, "It is incumbent upon the public and organizations to comply with statutes such as the ESA without an individual visit from the staff to advise them of public responsibility." So ideally, employment standards in the province work without extensive government interference. And this is where we're interested in exploring what we conceptualize as the deterrence gap in this paper, but more broadly in this project, as Leah was talking about, an enforcement gap, because this system of enforcement, as we and others have argued, leads to a number of problems, primarily many violations being undetected and many workers experiencing violations without any way of addressing them. This table gives us just a brief snapshot of some of the enforcement activities of the ministry in this earlier time period. And again, in terms of historical context, we're talking 1970s through to early 2000s. On this table, we have some basic data from the 1980s that just maps out, again, the activities, the primary enforcement activities of the ESA. And what we can see here is, for example, in terms of complaints or claims, as they're termed, around 15, 16,000 in the early 1980s, reaching up to around 21,000 by the 1990s, early 1990s. And these complaints sparking investigations, right, from the ministry in response to the complaints, not matching, right? There's a bit of a gap here. Again, all the way through, a gap of a couple of thousand, right, between the complaints raised and the investigations in pursuing those complaints. But at the same time, you can see the activity that's going on there. This is a gap. John referred to a gap of 14,000 complaints, right? This is something that's grown over time quite significantly. At the same time, in terms of understanding the issue of compliance, what we can see is in terms of these investigations, they uncovered around 70% of employers were in violation of the Act when it came to the complaints raised. These are the ones that, that were raised through the individual complaint system amongst non-unionized workers. In terms of, again, this is at the lower end of the, if we're thinking of the pyramid that Eric was talking about, and in terms of how the ministry understands its enforcement activities, this is a step up from the educational kinds of materials, but still far below the actual deterrent kind of activities that we're talking about in this paper. If we move to the top of the pyramid and look at something like prosecutions of employers who have violated the Act, we can see in relation to the number of complaints and even violations, it's a small number of prosecutions. In terms of the other aspect of how problems with employment standards are detected, there's the system of proactive inspections that Eric was talking about. And again, just very briefly, through the 1980s and 1990s, what we can see from the blue line here is a very sharp drop. In other words, the ministry really cut back on the number of inspections through this time period and then increased them in the late 1990s, but there's very clear, sharp decline. And the red line in here indicates the percentage of employers who are found to be in violation as a result of proactive inspection. And again, there's a general recognition that the proactive inspections program is important because it gets over the individualized nature of the complaints process, but it's been really what we argue in the paper and others have argued as well, underemphasized and underutilized. Now, what I want to do is, in the remaining time that I have, which is, I'm imagining, not too many minutes, but a few, two or three, I guess, talk through just very briefly what we've been able to collect from the ministry in terms of contemporary data on enforcement and deterrence. And again, just using the model of the pyramid as a starting point to recognize how the ministry approaches enforcement, we can see the movement from promotional activities at the bottom, which is the widest array, upwards towards the kinds of deterrent activities that we're interested in particular things like orders to pay, what we will call notices of contraventions and tickets, and prosecutions. And so I'll walk through some very brief data on this and then give some summary conclusions. In terms of proactive inspections, this is current data over the last decade. And again, we can see the proactive inspections program has it's grown a little bit, in particular when the Liberals took power about 10 years ago. The ministry was identified as by the Auditor General as being very delinquent in terms of employment standards enforcement, and so some money has been put into the proactive inspections program. But when we look at the numbers here, we're looking at just over 2,000 perhaps inspections, and we think about this in relation to the number of workplaces in Ontario and even the number of complaints that come in, and it remains relatively minor. The Workers' Action Centre argues, I think, about 1% of employers face the possible experience of being investigated proactively. So it's a low level. Taking it to the next step in the pyramid, as we'll call it, a new form of deterrence activity comes through orders to pay, which is where the employment standards investigators are empowered to issue orders to pay wages, to reinstate workers, and orders to comply when violations are detected. We have limited data on this. This is something we're trying to, collect more information about. Again, we can see in terms of the numbers, it's several hundred over the past couple of since 2001 to 2007. This is the limited data we have. So again, a relatively low number, but this is the first level that we're talking about when we get into the kinds of activities that might be of the order of deterrence that Eric was raising. The last slide that I have with our limited set of data, and then I'll bring this to a conclusion. There are several other mechanisms that the ministry has developed to undertake deterrent kinds of activities, the first being a notice of contravention, which, again, employment standards officers can issue to employers when the officer believes there's been a contravention of the act. Again, looking at the data, we see that there are relatively few of these that are being implemented. There are tickets, again, that are under Provincial Offences Act. Employers can be issued tickets for offences of the Act. Most frequently, we've seen tickets issued for things like overtime, hours of work, and holiday pay standards or provisions within the Employment Standards Act. Again, relatively small numbers of tickets. And then finally, employers can be prosecuted, right, for violating the Act. And again, what we've again, just in our brief snapshot from 2005 up until 2013, we're seeing relatively low number of prosecutions being pursued under the Act. I'm going to conclude. I know that the time is of the essence. In our small snapshot of the data that we've collected, what we've been able to glean from this, and what we're suggesting in the paper, that overall the use of deterrence tools, right, that are available to the ministry is extremely limited, right, over the last decade. Also, there's a lack of clarity. We've seen a drop in terms of the numbers of complaints that workers have been filing with the Ministry of Labor, but it's unclear as to whether this is because employers are actually addressing concerns or if because workers are reluctant to complain. And based on work that we've done through partnerships with the Workers' Action Centre and other kinds of organizations, we suspect more likely the latter. And so overall, then, when we're looking at this model of enforcement, what we can see is, thinking in the historical background and through to the present day, there's an overwhelming reliance on the compliance-based strategy and a reluctance, again, to enact the kinds of measures that would be called deterrence measures. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We're aiming to, follow this through in terms of collecting further data, and that's going to be an ongoing process. Okay, thanks.
Did you want to just stop that so that we're our question and answer period, which now begins? We have about half an hour for questions, comments, and answers. And so what I propose to do.